wait to be back into the Capitol in 2008, so welcome. We have an action-packed agenda today. Most of the information we're going to be hearing today is informational background materials. We will have a discussion towards the end on LC 70. I just want to say I just received the draft yesterday. With all due respect to Legislative Council, we appreciate their hard work, but we haven't had much time to review it. We will be looking for input today, so if folks are interested in coming up and sharing their issues or concerns or viewpoints on LC 70, I will be asking folks to come up. We don't have invited testimony, but certainly you're welcome to come up and share that. It's not an official public hearing. It's because this just came out, so it's going to be more informal. And then on the 25th of January, we're going to have an official public hearing. We're starting off with a very exciting topic, the Oregon Water Supply and Conservation Initiative. Hearing from the Water Resources Department, I briefly saw Director Phil Ward in the hall, and he said he's getting a lot of complaints about over-delivery right now because it's been raining nonstop for how many days and how many nights. But
is that what we call flooding now, is over-delivery?
Over-delivery. So first we're going to hear from Debbie Colbert and Barry Norris with the Water Resources Department. You've probably been hearing on and off over the past few months about work on the water supply conservation plan. They're going to provide us with an update on that, and then also about the Umatilla Basin Aquifer Storage Recovery Project. So first I'd like to have Debbie and Barry come up, and then we'll hear from a couple members of the Umatilla. Did you want to add anything?
Nope.
Okay. Good afternoon.
Good morning. Yeah. Thank you very much for having us today. Again, for the record, I'm Debbie Colbert, and I'm with the Water Resources Department. And with me today is Barry Norris, the state engineer with the Water Resources Department. And as you mentioned, we were going to start with a very quick update on our implementation activities under the Oregon Water Supply and Conservation Initiative. And this was a budget package that the governor put forward last session that the legislature chose to fund. And we were going to just quickly tell you a little bit about what's happening under the initiative and then spend the rest of the time filling you in on a project that we've been working with the governor's office on called the Umatilla Regional Aquifer Recovery Project. So tell you a little bit about what's involved in that effort. So with that, if it's okay with you, I'll turn it over to Barry Norris.
Okay. I'm Barry Norris with the Water Resources Department. We provided three handouts for you this afternoon. First of all, there's a handout that's the PowerPoint presentation. Secondly, there's a handout that is some detail on the San Francisco Umatilla Basin Aquifer Recovery and Assessment that our department prepared. And finally, there's a one-page handout that gives you a little bit of information about that LC 50 and as well as just an introduction to the recovery project as well. First thing I'd like to talk a little bit with you about is our Water Supply and Conservation Initiative. As you'll recall from the last time we spoke with you, that the initiative is in five parts, studying the existing and future water supply needs, inventory conservation projects, inventory of the potential storage sites, basin yield estimates, and match funding for community planning efforts. Now, I'll just, with your permission, talk about leave the first two for a minute and go to the last three. The last three are portions of the project that we're handling within our department. The first one is the inventory of potential storage sites. Now, that includes both above and below ground, where we've made quite a bit of progress since July. We've got a lot of the state mapped with potential above-ground storage sites, and we're in the process of developing information to tag to those sites. Eventually, we'll wind up with an interactive mapping site on our website where people can go click on a individual surface water storage site and find information that's tagged to that site, where what stage in the process of planning it or looking at it it's reached as well. And that goes the same for our below ground storage. We're in the process of developing the website. We've developed a lot of information statewide, and we're continuing to populate a database with things like any existing studies that have been done on storage below ground, aquifer characteristics, water availability, and those kinds of things. So this website will be similar to the above ground storage, where people can go click on an area and look at what's available as far as geology, geography, water availability, and then look at a rating that we'll eventually assign to that area as to the potential for storage below ground. The basin yield estimate, as you know, was not funded, and it's on hold until hopefully this summer we can start doing a little bit of work on that and moving ahead with it on our own. I don't know what type of progress we'll make on that. And then finally, the match funding for community and regional water supply planning. We will be coming out with a request for proposals this month, with a request that those proposals be received by March, sometime in March. And we expect to issue grants or contracts not to exceed $20,000, up to that amount, with a 25% match in April. And so we'll be getting the word out and with a request for proposals.
Barry, could you remind me who's eligible for those grants? Is it strictly public entities? Is it irrigation districts? What's the purview of the criteria for that?
Madam Chair, we have set it up so that any entity, private, public, is qualified to apply. They have to meet, minimum fiscal requirements, and then there's criteria that we're going to look at to ask whether they represent kind of a regional water supply approach, whether they're addressing other things besides water supply, land use, water quality. So it's pretty broad who can apply, but then there's these criteria that we'll use for ranking them that gets at how broad of an area, who they represent, do they have local government involved, those kinds of criteria.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Barry Norris again. Now back to the first two that have been contracted to an outside contractor. HDR Engineering was successful in getting the contract for both the assessment of existing and future supply needs as well as the inventory of conservation opportunities. We've had internal meetings with the contractor and gone through their proposal and ironed out some of the details on that. We've had a stakeholders meeting where we had a good participation from a lot of stakeholders from all over the state, where they had an opportunity to ask questions, interact with the contractor and the department, express any concerns, and just ask general questions about the project and how it would proceed. I guess I'd just tell you as an example of concerns, there was a concern over how the data might be used eventually, what we do about quality control in the data and how we would do quality assurance on that, those kinds of questions. And we were able to answer those with the stakeholders. And then this week we'll be meeting on Thursday with water utility people representing the water utilities around the state. We'll be doing the same thing that we did with the general stakeholders, answering their questions and going through the project, giving them details on the timelines and how we'll be acquiring the data and so on. And then next week, we'll be meeting up in Portland, the department, the contractor, and a peer review group that we organized to hear about the project, how we're going to go about it, our approaches and data acquisition, so on, and get their feedback as to what they think about our process and our work plan. So that's an update on the Water Supply and Conservation Initiative, and with your permission, then I'd move on to the Umatilla Aquifer Recovery questions.
Okay, let me see if there's any questions from any of the members on that first part. And just a refresher on the timing, when the study you'll be ready to present to us, sort of a final draft or initial draft?
We expect to be complete with the project by July.
Okay.
So we'll be giving you updates as we move through at your request or
whatever. That's great. Thank you. And anything that you can provide to us in writing ahead of time would be helpful as well, even if only certain components of the study are ready.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Let me correct myself. The contracting part is due by end of July. We'll be through with the other parts, the storage above ground, below ground. We expect this fall. but we'll be able to provide an update on that and give you examples of what we're doing by July easily, because we'll still be populating the database, but it should be functional. And then what we gave you a timeline on the match funding, of course, and then the basin yield estimates. I'm not sure about that. We'll just have to see how we're able to allocate resources to that.
All right. Thank you. And when you go into the Umatilla, can you just make sure and do a brief background just as a reminder for the committee members and for the audience what the issue is and, you know, why this is being brought forward?
We'll do that. Madam, excuse me.
Just, I think that, Madam Chair, with respect to just setting a little the stage for this portion of our presentation, I'm sure that all of the committee members remember that there was a lot of discussion last session about some of the critical water supply needs that we are observing in the Umatilla Basin. And this came up through legislative discussion during 2007. I think what we're going to present to you today starts out by setting some of the background in terms of why are there water supply needs in the Umatilla Basin, what factors are driving these needs, and then finish by telling you the proposal that we've developed to address some of these water supply needs.
Madam Chair, Barry Norris again with the Water Resources Department. A map of the state up on the board. The orange colors are critical groundwater areas. There are seven critical groundwater areas in the state, one over on the eastern side of the state, Cow Valley, one north-central at the Dalles, and then one at the north end of the Willamette Valley, Cooper Mountain, Bull Mountain. Cooper Mountain, Bull Mountain, and then, of course, four in the Umatilla Basin. The Cooper Mountain, Bull Mountain does have some cutbacks in water, where we've restricted water cut back some water users, but not nearly to the extent that I'll talk to you about in the Umatilla Basin. The other two, there have not been cutbacks in allocated water rights to users. The Dalles and over here on the east side. In the Umatilla Basin, there are four critical groundwater areas. This is a blow-up of the Umatilla Basin with the four critical groundwater areas. Beginning in 1976, we established the critical groundwater area in the ordinance and the salt and ordinance gravels. Two critical areas followed. The Butter Creek critical area and the Stage Gulch critical area were established in 1991. The purple area is a limited area where it's not critical. It's just been classified for future use. Now, let me explain just a little bit about the authority under the critical groundwater area and why we would establish a critical area. The critical groundwater area is an administrative process whereby the commission and the department can, it's the only administrative process where the department, under the authority of the commission, can restrict or cut back on existing water use with the water users under the terms of their water right permit. They have an established water right, but when there's a critical area that's been established, the department can go in and with the right science can establish that more water is being used than is naturally recharged, the aquifer is being mined, and so we can cut back on the amount of water that's allowed. And the way we have done that in the Umatilla Basin is to establish this, what's called a sustained annual yield. That sustained annual yield is the amount of water that we estimated at the time we established these areas could be withdrawn from the aquifers and maintain that on a sustainable basis, and which was less than the amount of water that was being withdrawn. So a number of irrigators lost their ability to irrigate from the groundwater, and a number of other irrigators were cut back on the amount of water that they were able to use under the terms of their water right. And then it's all been done, of course, to a priority system like other water right holders. Now, this table gives you an idea of the restrictions that have been put on water use. As an example, in the Butter Creek critical groundwater area, we've divided it into three sub-areas. The first one, the north sub-area, the groundwater rights in that area were allowed 2,690 acre-feet under their water right, but only 250 acre-feet of water were allocated under the sustained annual yield for that sub-area. So only 9% of the water that's allocated under a water right is it can actually only be used. Basin-wide, about 30% of the water that's allocated under the water rights is being used and was used in 2007. Now, on the bottom one, you can see the ordinance basalt, 6,800 acre feet were allowed, 6,800 acre feet were allocated under the sustained annual yield for that particular basalt critical groundwater area. Now, this is a hydrograph of a well in the ordinance critical groundwater area, and you can see in 1960 it started to drop the groundwater level. This is feet below surface going down in the well. So you can see the groundwater level had dropped as a result of using more water than was naturally recharged each year, down to about 1990 where it started to level off. Now, we didn't cut back on the amount of water, and we haven't so far in the basalt critical groundwater area. You can see, though, in the last 20 years or so, that there has been about a 10-foot drop. So there's still a little bit of mining going on, and it's not without possibility that at a later date, if things could continue the way they are, that there could be some restrictions in that area as well. So in some areas we've stabilized, some areas we've actually seen a little bit of recovery, in other areas we see maybe some continuing decline. Another close-up map of the basin, just a little bit of geography. The Columbia River, Umatilla River, coming down and down from Columbia River down and around over through Pendleton, the Butter Creek running up and connecting into the Umatilla River, Stanfield, Pendleton, Umatilla, Boardman. There's an existing pipeline for the Columbia Improvement District that comes down and drops exits water into a canal out into the heart of the ordinance critical area. The county line is right down through here, so we've got Morrow County and Umatilla County that splits the critical areas. So the ordinance critical area is split between two counties, as well as the Butter Creek area, and then the Stage Gulch area is within the Umatilla area. And this is, of course, I-84, freeway going through the heart of it. Right in here, if you're driving down the freeway, well, you'll see to the south of the freeway there's a large poplar plantation that probably a lot of you have noticed when you've driven by. On the Columbia River, we did a water availability analysis, which we collaborated with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. The way we did that, we took a look at our gauged information, and we arrayed all of the flows in the Umatilla River from the gauges from high to low. We drew a line in the middle, and that establishes a median or 50% exceedance flow. So half of the time the flow at that point is above that number, and half the time the flow at that point is below that number. It's a median flow in the river, which you could expect 50% of the time. We took those flows for each one of the months, and we subtracted from it target biological flows that the natural marine fisheries had set back in the year 2000. So if there was water left over, that meant that there was water that flowed half the time above those biological flows. If it's a minus number, that meant that the biological flows weren't met half the time. This is the amount of water that was left over after we subtracted the biological flows from the median flows. So where there's a negative number in either one of the rows, water, if you took out water, then you'd be taking out water when there's already a deficit in the target flows. If both numbers are positive, then you could remove water up to that amount, and you wouldn't be causing an effect on the target flows on a 50% exceedance. These are the months where you could take water out of the Columbia River, where you have positive numbers in the columns, where you would not be eating into the target flows on a 50% exceedance.
the Fish and Wildlife agreed with us that those would be the months where water would be available for to a full green. Now back to that map of the Umatilla Basin. Again, there was a kind of a critical that came together as far as a supply issue is concerned. We'd cut back water use in the critical areas to only 30% of that was allocated. This wasn't a future supply issue, it's an existing supply issue. People that have valid water rights were cut back. We know that there is water available in the Columbia River during certain months of the year, and that was through a water availability analysis in collaboration with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And there's a considerable amount of existing infrastructure in that area that moves water all around. A combination of different irrigation districts as well as some private infrastructure, which reduces, of course, the cost of any building on any new project. This, again, is the Columbia Improvement District. There is a supply line. There are pump stations that sit there right here on the Columbia River, and they move water down through a 72-inch pipeline. They can pump up to 300 cubic feet per second through that pipeline. They do that during the summer and supply water to irrigators. The water is moved into a canal system, and then water is taken out of the canal with pumps north and south and east for various irrigation projects. So with some winterization, there's a good possibility that that infrastructure could be used, improve on it, expand on it, and could be used for a water storage project. Additionally, there's a Columbia on the county line project, it's right about in here, that makes use of Umatilla water during the winter already, and they recharge a alluvial system. There's also another pump station that sits out here on the Columbia River and supplies some irrigators as well. So you could improve on that infrastructure, and you could use the county line project and expand on an already existing aquifer recharge project to serve other irrigators as well. This is that shallow alluvial system where the county line project is already recharging aquifer system. Some of that water, as we would overcharge it or expand on it, could result in return flows to the Umatilla River or possibly even Butter Creek. There's an alluvial system over here that is known as the Echo Meadows Project that has already had some study done on it but didn't reach real definitive conclusions. We can pick up on the information that's already been developed on that project and follow that through to determine the feasibility of storing water in the shallow alluvial system, which would benefit irrigators and likewise benefit the Umatilla River and return flows. So it would benefit the river as well as irrigators. And then the study would include looking at the deep basalt aquifers for recharge. One of the things about looking at the deep basalt aquifers for recharge is how do you treat the water so that you have no degrading of the existing groundwater supply. Now that's, of course, that has been done by places like Pendleton, the city of Salem, and other places where they're doing recharge, but it hasn't been done on a regional basis. And so this project would include developing the technology for treating that water so that you can inject it into the deep basalts, looking at individual sites for treating it, or treating it on a gross basis, say at a pumping location, or using the alluvial aquifers to treat it and then turn around and pump that down into the basalt aquifer system.
Okay, Representative Burley has a question about this.
Thank you. You mentioned the treatment for the deep aquifer but not for the shallow one. Why is that?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, for certain types of infiltration into the alluvials, the requirements for treatment aren't as strict as they are for injection into the basalts. The water tends to clean itself up, and it's not a direct injection project, which would be under the jurisdiction of EPA requirements.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Keep going.
Madam Chair, that's about all that I prepared.
Debbie, do you have anything you want to add about a project before we call up some of the members of the community?
Well, I guess just in closing, you know, as Barry mentioned, we were trying to design a project that would get at these big needs in the Umatilla Basin, but was smart in that it took advantage of the existing infrastructure that we have out there and looking at ways to use both the shallow and the deep basalt aquifers as storage system. And so that's kind of some of the things that Barry has highlighted for you, unless you have any other questions.
Barry?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I did forget one important thing that I wrote down and I told myself I did not want to forget. And I want to just really emphasize that this has been a real collaborative effort to come up with the some of the details of this project. It's included Umatilla County Commission, it's included Morrow County Commission, it's included the Groundwater Task Force in Umatilla County, Chair Kent Madison is here today, it's included the Umatilla Tribe, individual irrigators, irrigation districts. Everybody seems to be on board and moving in the same direction on this project.
Okay. Two questions or clarification that I'd like to ask. As far as above ground storage, then this, what you're talking about, this proposal no longer involves above ground storage. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. This project is now entirely focused on recharging the shallow aquifers and doing the direct injection in the deep basalt.
And in your handout, you talk about money for studies. So that would be to look at the feasibility of this as a regional project, and that involves planning money only, not any construction funds if necessary.
Madam Chair, Barry Norris again. That's correct. It would be an assessment subcategory of planning. We would be, first of all, looking at the phase one, we'd be looking at the project in total, trying to prioritize the various components of the project to see where what the build-out might be and what would be the most feasible at the beginning of the project and so on. The second part would be zeroing in on the most feasible parts and doing some site investigations and some detailed analysis of those individual sites. And then finally, the third part would be to do some pilot studies, planning, moving water under a limited license, looking for possibly some help from the irrigators out there in doing that and seeing if the water actually, as you inject it or move it into the alluvial system, reacts as the theory and science would tell you it does.
Okay. So the $750,000 that's written into the fact sheet, that's what you're asking for, the planning money, and you're requesting that through a bill that's been put through the Senate. Is that correct? It's been tacked on to House Bill 3203, is my understanding.
Madam Chair,
or would be earmarked as part of that.
That is correct. And actually, on the back side of this one pager, we've provided a description of that concept that is moving forward on the Senate side, and this project would be a part of that legislative concept.
Okay. And do you know what the total amount that's being requested? Maybe Beth can. Want to just provide the committee, since the bill is not coming through this committee, it's coming from the Senate side, a little bit of background, because this is sort of providing, you know, the context, because eventually we will be asked to make a decision on that bill, I'm assuming.
Yes. The bill that's coming through the Senate committee is LC 50, and what it does is combines basically the idea that was in House Bill 3203 from last session. So a fund of money for the Water Resources Department to give grants to communities or individuals. I guess it's a fairly wide open pool of people who can apply for these grants to do feasibility studies for water supply projects. So the LC 50 draft combines 3203 with some changes with the appropriation for the Umatilla feasibility study and to set up a mitigation bank in the Umatilla. So the combination of the feasibility study and the mitigation bank is $1.25 million, $750,000 for the study and $500,000 for the mitigation bank. And then the amount for the other potential studies under the 3203 portion I think it right now it's at 10 million, but that's a little bit uncertain at this point.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Burling and Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I understand this, there's three different ways, really, you could be storing water: above ground, the shallow alluvial aquifer recharge, or the deep basalt aquifer recharge. Just in general terms, could you rank those in order of least expensive to most expensive?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, it really depends on who you want to serve. If you were just trying to store water for the sake of storing water, then obviously moving it out and spreading it over the ground and infiltrating into shallow basalts might be the least expensive. But if you're trying to serve the largest number of people, or you're targeting where you need the water the most, it's likely that the deep injection would be the way you want to go, because you have a number of users now that are using the downhole, the basalt aquifers that are out of water, and those aquifers need to be replenished. So it depends on who you want to serve and where you want the water. It would be in some situations, as an example, more expensive to inject it into the alluvials and then move it for miles over to service somebody that would that's not near the alluvial aquifers that needs the water. Another thing to consider as well is the capacity of the alluvial system. We don't know what that is. We don't know how rapidly the water will move through the alluvial system and exit out as springs and provide return flows. While that's a good thing, it may not, to enhance flows in the Umatilla River, it may not be the best thing for irrigators that want to use it. In other words, recharging in the winter and expecting it to be there in mid to late summer. So those things have to be answered.
Thank you. So if I understand what you're saying, the deep basalt aquifer injection is probably the most expensive way to go. But because of the fact that we've got users that don't get any allocation right now out of that aquifer, it's an expense that we ought to be investing in. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, that could be true. I think it all boils down to our ability to find a way of treatment. Treatment could be very expensive. Maybe it won't be so expensive. And that is an answer that I can't speak to, or that's a question I just really can't speak to right now until we've had a chance to study what the existing water quality is, what the water quality is in the aquifer system, and how do we assure that we don't have degradation in that existing water. So it really depends on, we're going to be pumping the water anyway, so it really depends on what treatment options are available.
So one last question.
Last follow-up?
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So just to make sure that we're all clear on this, though, this study will give equal attention to both the deep basalt aquifer as well as the shallow alluvial aquifer.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, that's correct. We'll be writing the proposal, if we get to that stage, to ask the consultant to go through the process, give equal attention up to the point where perhaps we'll find a fatal flaw. Maybe the alluvial system won't work for certain reasons. I don't know what those reasons might be, or maybe some places in the aquifer system the basalt injection won't work and some will. I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Columbia River flow numbers, I just want to make sure I understand this correctly. At the term 50% exceedance, is that basically saying that the median flow at each of these months would be enough to provide the amounts you've described here? It's a median type of number?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, that's right. It's a median flow. And I apologize for that confusing concept. I talk about median and 50% exceedance, and people's eyes roll back in their heads, and I just haven't figured out a way to. Sometimes I get mixed up, and I explain it wrong, too. So but that's right. It's a median.
I'll follow up on that. So medium would mean that 50% of the time, and I think you said this, 50% of the time the flow would be greater than the number here, and 50% of the time the flow would be less. I suppose it would be interesting and relevant to know how much that varies above and below the median.
Let's see. You mean, Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, you mean you would be interested in seeing the array to see what type of outliers there are? Mm-hmm. As an example, are there high flows that provide an enormous amount of acre feet that would skew it, say, on an average? It'd be much higher number if you used an average.
Right, yes.
Would you like us to provide that now?
Yeah, I think just getting... Now, I tend to be suspicious of averages, no matter whether they're averages or medians, without getting a little more of the context to see what they're really showing. And to just see the median, I think, doesn't provide enough. There could be that there are numbers much higher or much lower, in which case the median would tend to be a good usable number going forward in order to picture how much water there is in the river. It may be the case that there, because I know nothing about this subject, may be the case there are big swings one direction or another in a given month, which may make a difference to our thinking about this.
Okay. And also I'll probably will invite the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to come and talk a little bit, since they are the ones who actually work with you in setting the standard for, you know, how much water is enough for fish recovery. And also we can have them talk about the interaction with the biop, I think would be interesting. So with that, we're sort of running short on time. We have two more people that would like to come up and make comments about this proposal. So really appreciate you being here today, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you soon again with more updates, so especially during the session, because you'll be continuing to work on this. So thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Next, I'm going to call up Kent Madison from the Umatilla Basin and Rick George from the Umatilla Tribes, who have been working on this project, and I've asked them to come make some brief comments, and appreciate you both coming here today. I know the roads have been quite treacherous, so I hope you're not driving back this afternoon. Kent, why don't you get started?
Committee, Madam Chairman, I'm Kent Madison out of Echo, Oregon. I'm the chairman of the Groundwater Task Force. I'm a third-generation farmer in the area, and I'm in the heart of the Butter Creek Critical Groundwater Area, the Echo Junction section of that. I have been allocated off over the last 15 or 20 years, and we've developed the technology in our area where we take winter Butter Creek flood flows, very similar to what we're proposing on this project, put them onto the shallow alluvial aquifer plain, recharge the shallow alluvial area, recover that through deep buried drain tiles, pull that water back out, treat it with a chlorination process, and inject it down a deep basalt well, the one that has been turned off by the state, and have long-term storage water that way. So the technology that we're proposing on the broader scale has been evolved and has been used in the area and is very successful. So we can take high turbidity winter flood waters and make it potable water through that shallow alluvial system, and it works really quite well. And it's fairly inexpensive from the process of a treatment standpoint. And we do meet all the federal drinking water quality standards in the process of doing that. So it's a great technology. The advantage of having a declined aquifer, if there is an advantage, is we now have a huge storage basin. And we have a huge storage basin with everybody's pumps stuck into that basin. So to recharge into that basin at strategic locations, we can rebuild that aquifer and allow the existing infrastructure that's there to withdraw that water back out. So that's the advantage of aquifer storage and recovery, is you can utilize your existing infrastructure and utilize nature's ability to deliver water to people without having to put in pipelines and things like that. So this project has public or private irrigator benefits, it has municipality benefits, it has exempt well user benefits, it has, because of the shallow alluvial component of it, it has return flow benefits to the fisheries and to the lower stretches of the Umatilla River, which also creates mitigation flows into the Columbia River during the summer months and allows additional use of that water during the summer months. So it's a very positive project, and I can stand before you today and say that we have not had a single individual in the Umatilla Basin at this point in time come to us and say that this is not a good project. So I can't think of a more cohesive group of people that are in support of something. With that, I'll let Rick talk about the tribal side of the equation. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Rick, thanks for coming today.
You're very welcome, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rick George, and I'm a staff member with the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. In answer to your question, Chair Dingfelder, we drove down this morning, and I'm not driving back today. I'm going to wait for the roads to clear up. It was a difficult drive this morning. On behalf of the Umatilla tribes, as you know, the Umatilla Basin is heralded as a basin that is characterized by almost unparalleled consensus building and the potential for doing great things. The Umatilla Basin Project has restored stream flows in the Umatilla River. It was developed by irrigators and tribes and environmental groups and others. We now have salmon back in the river. Three stocks that had been completely extinct for a century. We have stream flows back in the Umatilla River again. The Umatilla River was dry for a century, and it's really a result of the collaboration and the cooperation, and I think most importantly the leadership in the Umatilla River Basin. And Kent and myself are here today to tell you that that leadership has come together again between the end of the last session and today to craft legislation that is supported by the most amazing diversity of leadership from the irrigation community, county government, the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, whose Board of Trustees reviewed the draft legislation yesterday and indicated their formal support for it, the Port of Umatilla. And I think most important in the context of people stepping forward and saying we want to help, you've got the folks that own the infrastructure in the basin, millions of dollars worth of delivery infrastructure and pumps out of the Columbia River that have been at these meetings in the last couple of weeks to participate under the leadership of Kent and with all of the other basin representatives to develop this legislation. And they've indicated clearly that they want to have their infrastructure analyzed as part of the fix for the critical groundwater area. So I just think that the basin has done great work. We're here to tell you that, and we're here to thank you very much for the opportunity you've given the basin to fix its own problems with the assistance of the Water Resources Department and with the leadership and vision of the legislature and the basin working together. So on behalf of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, we're pleased to be here to indicate our support and happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen, for making the trek here today. I think we have a question from the far right of the podium.
She got that right, didn't she? Rick, I was just going to comment, congratulations on bringing these groups together. And when you're done there, come on down to the climate face. We need that same kind of effort. But congratulations. Few people know what an effort that must have taken.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Garrard, I just want to say thank you for that. And I might point out that Representative Garrard is on my far left. We'd be happy to visit the Klamath in a decade or so.
Thank you. Any other questions? I just want to say thank you, gentlemen, for your hard work. I know many, well, besides yourself, you know, many people spent hours and hours and of their lives working on this for many, many years. So really pleased that we're able to come together, and we'll certainly be talking more about it in about a month or so. But even though this bill's starting on the Senate, it'll be coming through here, and I expect to see you again probably in about a month to come provide some more testimony. I think it would be helpful also if there's other members of the community, you know, certainly hearing from the municipal side, from any of the residents that aren't necessarily irrigators that have individual wells, getting different perspectives would be helpful just so we have a wide range. And I think as we move forward with these two bills, it's now one, but just to remember, just for the committee members to remember, this is just funding the study. There still will be efforts. I don't know if you guys are now looking at how, if there needs to be capital improvements, how that will be paid for, if that's going to be through bonds or whatever, but this is just the first part. Still a long way to go, but hopefully it's a step in the right direction. So, great.
Madam Chairman, we would ask that your staff allow or let us know at what time you would like more people, because we've got all kinds of people who can fill the room with lots of support, but we want to do that at the proper time. So
we will.
Okay, thank you very
great.
Much.
Great. Thank you, John.
Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Next, we're going to have updates on a couple of pieces of legislation that came through this committee last session, and that is the bottle bill expansion that was passed. You probably remember that the bottle bill was expanded to include plastic water bottles, and one of our esteemed members of this committee is sitting on the bottle bill task force, Representative Cannon, and he's going to give us an update on how the task force is doing as part of the bottle bill expansion. It was also sort of a process for looking at further expansions or changes of the bottle bill was created, because there was still a lot of concern about how our bottle bill expansion was going to affect our existing system. So my understanding is bottle bill task force started meeting the end of last year, and they're looking at issues regarding implementation of the new bill and also at how we might be able to make our current system work better or any changes that we need in our current system. So Representative Cannon's going to give us a brief update, and then we're going to hear from the Department of Environmental Quality on the computer recycling bill, another bill that passed last session. Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be brief. The bottle bill task force has met just twice. I attended the second of those two meetings, and we're still at the early stages of our conversation about what the next generation of a bottle bill may look like. The goal in our charge is to come back with recommendations for the 2009 legislature, so it is a task force that should complete its work this year. Our last meeting focused on the possibility of creating recycling centers and moving some of the redemption activity out of grocery stores and into sort of standalone or maybe parking lot or maybe attached to grocery store type of centers that are dedicated to bottle returns. And there was considerable interest on the part of the committee to doing that, particularly if we intend to expand the container list beyond the soda, beer, and water that will come on next year. So that was the focus of our last meeting. Again, I think there's considerable interest in moving in that direction. The real hook there and the point of contention, I think, will be just how to pay for that. And subsequent meetings will consider that issue. We'll be looking at the amount of the deposit, currently still at 5 cents. We'll be looking at what containers might be included beyond the water bottle expansion that we made with 707. And we'll be looking at, as I said, financing, including, you know, possibilities for tracking the unredeemed deposits or requiring, you know, others to sort of step forward and help fund what might create a better system, namely the inclusion of recycling centers. So that seems to be the direction that we're heading in, but it's still very early, and expect more updates later in the year.
Great. Thank you, Representative Cannon. We'll look forward to updates. We appreciate your service on the committee.
Thanks.
It's good to have somebody who sat through all the testimony to be there on the committee. It's a good segue, I think, for the next stage. So with that, I'm going to ask Palmer Mason from the Department of Environmental Quality to come up and talk about progress on implementing the computer recycling bill that passed unanimously in both the House and Senate, came through this committee last session. And Palmer, you want to introduce yourself, because this is the first time I think you've come new face?
I am a new face.
Yes.
My name is Palmer Mason with the Department of Environmental Quality. I don't know if this is a good thing to say or a bad thing to say, but I'm the new Bob Danko. I'm taking his place for, is that a bad thing? Somebody said bad. I'll tell Bob.
Should we start the three-year clock?
Yeah.
Yeah, Bob.
It took us 30 years to get rid of Bob.
Really? Okay. Maybe it won't be so long. I'll work on the bottle bill, too.
Bob, we love you. Sorry, that was just a joke.
Yeah, he's heading off to retirement, not quite there, working part-time on the bottle bill issues, and I'm taking his place on other land quality issues. So that's a brief introduction for me. But, Madam Chair, I know here to talk about the e-waste program, so let me give you that update. I'm not going to dwell a lot on the background since I was at another committee meeting and did that, but if you want to follow along, I gave staff a copy of my testimony, so I'm going to focus probably a little bit more on the back part of that. It's the schedule of activities that EQ is working on. I did want to say two things, though, or a couple things, rather, about background, just to frame up the discussion of what DEQ has done to date and what we'll be doing in the near future. One is that by December of last year, December of 2007, the manufacturers who are outlined in the bill needed to register their brands for their different products. And we're talking about computers, monitors, TVs and laptops. Those are the principal items that we're talking about. That process is underway, and we have up to date, and I'll talk about a little bit more. We have 95 manufacturers registered. The other two other key dates that happen is in January of 2009, retailers cannot sell those products, monitors, computers, laptops, and TVs, unless that manufacturer has registered with the department and has either been a part of the state-sponsored plan for recycling or submitted their own plan to describe how they will handle the recycling of e-waste. So retailers won't be selling those products unless that happens. And then in January 1 of 2010, there is a prohibition on the landfill disposal of those items. So those are sort of the major milestones in the bill. Where is DEQ to date? When I met with the committee before, we talked about the fact that we've recruited and hired staff to implement the program. We hired three staff by October of 2007. We have set up a system of manufacturer registrations, and you'll see as another bullet down there, we've launched that on time and on schedule and received 95 registrations to date. There are still more rolling in, but it looks like most people, most manufacturers got the message and registered on time. The other thing that we've done to date is we've convened a group of different diverse stakeholders to help us with the implementation issues. We've had three meetings. There's another meeting scheduled January the 16th to continue that. And we've also had several meetings of the subgroups on various issues. We've also made substantial progress, but not yet complete, with some technical assistance materials that will be used for the manufacturers should they decide to have their own plans. And then the other thing that we've made substantial progress on, and this is a pretty pivotal point for the program, is a RFP for the selection of the contractor to manage the state-sponsored system. The way House Bill 2626 outlines the approach to e-waste is that manufacturers have the option of participating in a DEQ-administered program, or they have the option of choosing their own program. So that RFP speaks to DEQ's program, that where we will select a contractor to manage the state-sponsored program. That is expected to be released this January, at the end of this month. Then we get into the sort of the schedule of activities that are pending and yet to come. One of those things is the RFP that comes out at the end of the month. The other thing that we're also going to be starting this month and going forward is providing notification to the retailers of that January 1, 2009 deadline, wherein they will not be able to sell those covered electronic devices unless the manufacturer has registered and has either elected to participate in the DEQ program or have their own recycling plan. In March and April of this month, we expect to get proposals back on the RFP for the state contractor program. Then April through June, we'll be negotiating with the chosen contractor, and then ultimately by July of 2008, we hope to select a contractor. This summer is a pretty important point for the program, because at that point, we'll have a contractor selected, and then manufacturers will have to make that choice. Do they go off and do their own plan, or do they participate in the DEQ program? One thing that will happen before this summer is after we've selected the contractor, we will need to come back to the legislature, probably, I guess, the Interim Committee on Ways and Means, and get legislative authority to spend the dollars necessary to execute the contract with the contractor and go forward with that program. So we'll be back in front of the legislature probably in June of 2008. Also in the summer of 2008, we'll be setting up the registration fees. So manufacturers know how much they will have to spend in order to register and the amount of recycling that they're responsible for. And in the first few years, the recycling information won't be based on Oregon-specific information. We're going to have to rely on some national data and data from other states. But as the program gets up and running over the next couple of years, we'll shift to Oregon-specific data, and that will define what manufacturers are responsible for. And then this summer of 2008, if manufacturers choose to submit their own plans, we'll be reviewing those. And then lastly, in 2009, we'll be back to the legislature to report on how the program is doing. So that's kind of a quick update.
Thank you, Palmer. And so right now you would say that you're on track as far as implementation starting January 1, 2009?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think so. There's still some work to do on some of the technical assistance guidance that we want to provide to the manufacturers. The RFP is a critical point in the process that's nearly done. We'll see what the proposals are that come back from interested entities. But I think that we're on track so far. And then, as I said, we'll be back to legislature in June to get the dollar authority.
And how does this timing work with the transition for HDTV? Because we talked about that during the 5 years that we were discussing this bill, and there's going to be a huge influx of old TVs that will be coming. Will this system be in place when that transition happens?
Madam Chair, yes, it will be. We are anticipating that. My understanding is from some of the TV manufacturers that may be less of a problem than we all would have envisioned. But because what's already happening in today's market is people are turning over their TVs pretty fast because everybody's moving to flat screens. So the turnover rate in TVs is happening pretty quick, and the newer flat screens have all the digital capacity that they need in order to meet the federal change. So I think that turnover has somewhat already started, but we are expecting a bit of an influx, and we should be ready.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions? Ready? Representative Cannon.
On that point, Will DEQ make any effort, or are you aware of any effort to encourage consumers to wait until this recycling program comes into effect before disposing of or actually recycling their television, those consumers who are changing out in order to be able to watch television after the changeover happens a year from now?
Madam Chair, Representative, we're not making any special effort to ask people to wait. I think our interest has been focused on trying to get the program up and running, and that won't really happen until this summer at the earliest, where we start to have our state contractor out there or the manufacturers are out putting their plan in place, and it really doesn't become effective until January of 2009. So we could tell people that if Congress has made this change happen, and it will happen, and if they want to keep their TVs for another 6 months, they could, but they won't really have a place to go in terms of this bill until January of 2009. What maybe we could do, Representative, is as we get to the summer and we start to know how the contractor program will look and how the manufacturer programs will look, we can start our PR process at that point and making people aware of the option, whether they're talking laptops, TVs, computers, just making them aware that all this is coming in January of 2009. I think that's incumbent on us to do that. I don't know if I answered your question. Hopefully I did.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there will be a big infusion of televisions into landfills or recycling centers as we approach this deadline a year from now, this HDTV turnover a year from now. And it makes sense, insofar as possible, to capture those used televisions into this program. So
absolutely.
Asking consumers who may be buying their new TV this summer but don't have a free recycling option to suggesting that they hang on for six more months, you know, keep it in their basement, but turn it into the recycling program.
Madam Chair, what I can do, Representative, is find out exactly when we anticipate making the consumer aware of this program in general, which will speak to the issue of what do they do with their TVs.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So,
thanks.
Great, good point. Okay. Any other questions? All right, well, we'll look forward to updates as you continue. Thanks so much, Palmer.
And I'll give the regards to Bob. So.
Tell him we miss him. Okay, next, we're actually going to hear from another DEQ person, Andy Ginsberg, who is with the Air Quality Program, and Mark Reeve, who's chair of the Greenhouse Gas Reporting Advisory Committee. Committee members, we are going to hear an update on the greenhouse gas reporting rules. And, gentlemen, if you can just start from the beginning a little bit with your timeline, just the background information on the rules, why these are important, and, of course, it also fits in with our discussion later on LC-70. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at DEQ, and with me, as you just heard, is Mark Reeve, who is a former chair of the Environmental Quality Commission and currently is chair of our Greenhouse Gas Reporting Advisory Committee. We're going to give you an overview of greenhouse gas emission reporting and what we're doing about that, and a little bit of context, as you just requested, Madam Chair, how it fits into other greenhouse gas climate change activities that are going on right now, and also briefly mention related portions of LC70 that have to do with reporting. Historically, the Department of Energy has been in the lead on climate change, and DEQ has been assisting but really hasn't taken an active role. But that's changing. DEQ and the Environmental Quality Commission have become much more engaged in the climate change issue, and probably our biggest activity recently is in late 2005 when the Environmental Quality Commission adopted the Oregon Low Emission Vehicle Program, which will significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions from passenger vehicles and trucks, light-duty trucks. And Mark, we've also chaired that advisory committee that led to the adoption of that rule. You may have heard in the news recently that the Environmental Protection Agency just denied the waiver that California needs to implement that program, and indirectly that also prevents us from implementing the program. We have joined a lawsuit supporting California along with 14 other states to reverse the EPA decision related to the waiver. But until that happens, until the waiver is approved or the lawsuit is successful, we'll still be implementing the low-emission vehicle program, but the climate change elements of it will have to be on hold until that waiver issue is resolved. At the governor's request, DEQ is now working on a greenhouse gas emission reporting rule, and our advisory committee has just completed its recommendations. Mark's going to summarize those for us in a minute. But the Environmental Quality Commission has existing authority to adopt this rule, but because there's some unique aspects about greenhouse gas emissions, we thought it would be prudent to clarify their authority, and I'll go into that in a moment. But LC70 includes elements that would eliminate any potential uncertainty that would be in the Environmental Quality Commission's authority to implement the advisory committee's recommendations. So I'll be going back to that in just a minute and walking you through that. But first, I just want to give a brief recap of recent activities related to greenhouse gas emissions. In February, the governor joined the Western Climate Initiative, which is an organization that's committed to developing regional greenhouse gas emission reduction targets. All the members of the Western Climate Initiative agreed to participate in a multi-state reporting registry that would be a multi-state database to keep track of where all the emissions are coming from, and also to develop a market-based program such as a cap-and-trade program to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In May, Oregon became a founding member of the Climate Registry, which is a multi-state effort, including 40 states now, all Canadian provinces, and several tribes, as well as one Mexican state. And the Climate Registry is the database where all the greenhouse gas emission reports will be contained, and it will be the central repository for the data that would support any state's greenhouse gas emission reduction programs, whether voluntary or regulatory. In June, as you know, the legislature adopted House Bill 3543, and that creates the Global Warming Commission and also codifies the state's greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. And then in July, the governor asked the Environmental Quality Commission to consider adoption of a greenhouse gas emission reporting rule. And the purpose of that is first to improve our understanding of where greenhouse gas emissions come from, but also to allow the reporters to have a better handle on where the emissions are in their facilities and how they can make reductions and then possibly receive credit for those reductions in a future cap-and-trade program. And most importantly, the reporting is necessary. If we are going to move into a cap-and-trade program, the reporting is a key element of that. And then in October, DEQ appointed the Greenhouse Gas Reporting Advisory Committee, which Mark chairs. And so now I'm going to turn it over to Mark, who will summarize the recommendations of the committee. And then after that, I'll go back to LC70 and talk about how that will help us implement the advisory committee's recommendations.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mark Reeve, and Chair of the Greenhouse Gas Reporting Advisory Committee. As Andy mentioned, it has been a very quick process for an advisory committee. The typical DEQ advisory committee is often works over a period of years, let alone months or weeks. Here we got together in October and have been able to, with great support from DEQ staff and very good collaborative work by a pretty diverse group of stakeholders, come up with our recommendations already and the report that we expect to be able to put out later this month. So it's been quite an effort to put this together quickly, but we've tried to be responsive to the governor's request on this, in this matter. The recommendations fall really into three broad areas. The first is that we do recommend DEQ and EQC adopt rules for all electric suppliers in Oregon, that there be mandatory reporting for those emissions, and that on a voluntary basis to start with, out-of-state electric utilities also report. We certainly saw that there was some question of authority, and I believe Andy will speak to that question in a moment concerning the out-of-state suppliers. We also recommended that there be reporting of sales and transportation of other fuels such as natural gas, oil, propane, etc., and reporting of system losses. Finally, the third large area where we are recommending mandatory reporting is for industrial sources, which we recommend include, to begin with at least, all Title V and air contaminant discharge permit holders, that is, those are the existing industrial sources that are permitted by DEQ for their air emissions. We discussed but did not adopt any particular thresholds for those reporting requirements, but felt that a fairly broad first approach would be helpful in terms of gaining the understanding that we need for understanding better what our CO2 emissions are from industrial sources in the state. We think probably at the rule adoption stage there will be some phase-in of that so that it becomes not a burden, not an excessive burden on the regulated industry. We had two subcommittees of the committee meet. One was the electric and the utility subcommittee. The other was a mobile source committee. There was considerable discussion about mobile sources, and I should back up for just a moment. The committee as a whole tried to gain some context on emissions reporting by looking at what we had by way of existing information on an inventory of sources, so that we have some context for if we are requiring reporting from one entity, how does that fit into the overall picture of emitters in the state. So the inventory really is the inventory of all emissions in the state for greenhouse gases. Within that inventory, it quickly became clear that while industrial sources are one large source, and obviously electrical use and generation is another large source, transportation and mobile sources is also a very large source, and yet it is very diverse. We had a lot of discussion about whether there was any effective reporting mechanism for transportation, meaning cars and trucks and fleets, et cetera. At this point, the committee is not recommending any particular mandatory reporting requirement for transportation or mobile sources, but is suggesting that we do the DEQ start a task force at least by later this year to look into what are some of the options. That dovetails, I think, with the approach that's being taken by the Western Climate Initiative, though you may hear more about that from Dave Vantoff later today. The other issue that we did not directly make recommendations about was agriculture and forestry. Agriculture and forestry also contain within those sectors greenhouse gas emissions, and yet the committee did not find any effective way of suggesting mandatory reporting at this time, and also there's some uncertainties of how the Western Climate Initiative may attack those sectors. So we again recommended that there be some dialogue between DEQ, ODF, Department of Ag in terms of how greater information could be pulled together and some alternatives be discussed about whether it makes sense to include them in a future rulemaking or not. Finally, the committee did make, so those are a couple of the ag and forestry on the one hand, mobile sources on the other, were some areas where we did not make specific recommendations. We did make some specific recommendations on some of the procedures and the who, what, why, where, how these rules may actually move forward and be implemented in terms of protocols, use of the climate registry as a reporting vehicle, and things like that. So in the very short period of time that our committee had, I think we frankly were able to accomplish quite a bit. And in part, I'd like to quickly recognize and thank DEQ staff for their real assistance in doing it. Andy and his folks, and also in the audience today is Mary Ann Fitzgerald from DEQ, who very ably supported us. So thanks. Back to Andy.
Thank you. So Andy, you're going to walk us through, actually it's sort of a good segue, because there has been some questions about the part of LC70 on the DEQ authority, so I think that would be a good chance to explain that, and then we'll have more discussion on LC70 after we hear from Dave Bantoff.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to focus specifically on Section 4, which begins on page 3, line 18. That is the primary section of LC70 that addresses emission reporting. And it amends ORS 468A.050, which is the EQC's existing authority to require registration and reporting of emission sources. And what it does specifically in Section 4.1B and also in Section 4.3, which is on the next page, it would clarify the Environmental Quality Commission's authority to require reporting related to imported or distributed electricity or fuel. So let me explain why that's important. For the most part, at DEQ, we're concerned about emissions that occur in Oregon. In most cases, we're talking about regional or local impacts of pollutants, and we regulate the emissions that occur in Oregon, and our sister agencies in other states regulate the emissions that occur in their states, and sometimes we collaborate on larger multi-state issues, but generally speaking, we only think about the emissions that occur in our state. With global warming, it's a little different, and particularly in the electricity sector. In Oregon, much of our electricity is actually generated out of state, and so if we only look at the emissions that occur in state, we're missing a large percentage of the emissions from that sector. So instead, the way the Department of Energy recommends and the way our advisory committee recommended that we look at this is to consider the demand for electricity in Oregon and all the greenhouse gas emissions that are associated with that demand, regardless of where the power is generated. And it's just not clear in ORS 468A.050 and related definitions whether or not the commission can require reporting from the importers of electricity. A similar scenario comes up when we think about fuel suppliers. For example, if you're a propane distributor, the emissions occur when your customer purchases the propane and burns the fuel. So you're not technically an emission source, but that's the most logical place for us to collect information about emissions associated with that fuel rather than asking each consumer, for example, to report. So Section 4.1b and Section 4.3 would clarify that as probably the most important, most significant piece of this legislation with regard to greenhouse gas reporting. Section 4 section 4.4 on page 4, line 16, is the next issue. And that provision would authorize the Environmental Quality Commission to require reports to be made to the Climate Registry. So now, our advisory committee recommended that reports initially go to DEQ, and we intend in the initial rulemaking to allow the reports to go directly to DEQ. But some of our reporters are multi-state operations. It's much more convenient for them to report to the Climate Registry, where they report on all of their facilities nationally, maybe even internationally. So ultimately, if we are going to have a cap-and-trade program, it will be necessary for the reports to be made to the Climate Registry. Otherwise, Oregon facilities wouldn't be able to trade emissions with facilities in other states. That's the common currency will happen through the Climate Registry. And we're not sure if the Commission currently has the authority to require an entity to report to a third party rather than reporting to DEQ. So this would clarify that and allow us to require reports to either go to DEQ or to the Climate Registry, which would be much more cost-effective for the state. Also, we don't have to build a duplicative database when all that is being handled, all the protocols are handled by the Climate Registry. That's why we formed the Climate Registry. And then similarly, section 4.5 on page 4, line 22, allows the commission to require third-party verification. Typically, emission reports that are made to DEQ, DEQ staff will do, well, the facilities will verify that it's accurate. DEQ staff will do the oversight of that. And initially with the greenhouse gas reporting rule, that's how we would intend to move forward. But ultimately, if reports are made to the Climate Registry, the protocols of the Climate Registry require that there's an independent third-party verification. And the reason that's important is that once you report to the Climate Registry, your emissions get converted essentially into currency. You can trade those emissions with some other facility, and there has to be verification so that when one facility says, I reduced one ton of emissions and I'm selling it to another facility that needs to buy one ton, a ton has to be a ton. And that's why the Climate Registry is requiring independent third-party verification. So this would clarify the Commission's authority to require that. Again, we wouldn't be doing that initially, but ultimately if we move into a cap and trade program, that would be necessary. And then finally, on section 3 of the bill, on page 2, line 30, there are some definitions, amendments to ORS 468A.005. Those are definitions that were adopted last session as part of House Bill 3543, and the way that bill was adopted, the definitions only apply to the new provisions in the bill. This moves them into the general definitions in the Air Quality Division and allows the same definitions to apply to anything we do on greenhouse gases, including the submission reporting.
Thank you, gentlemen. And I want to leave some time for questions about any of the information that was presented or sections 3, or we're going to limit the questions to sections 3 or 4 of the bill because we'll be discussing the rest of LC 70 here in a moment. So any questions?
How much time do we have, Chair?
Probably about another 10 minutes, and then I'm going to have David Vantoff come up. And then I promised Representative Garrard that we would get out of here in time. I'm going to try to get him out so he can drive back to Klamath Falls. But I would like to try to end on time for this. We will have a lot of time during the next few weeks if people have more comments to email, call, write in, and then also we'll have another full hearing on the 25th where the majority of it will be spent on this. But certainly, if you have specific questions regarding these sections or any of these recommendations, I'll let you start and
Thank
see if there's
you. I've got a lot of questions about the whole reporting thing in general, and I guess I'm kind of struggling here whether to get into that now or maybe wait for Mr. Vantoff, because a lot of it does kind of focus on Western Climate Initiative. I'm a little bit curious, though, Mr. Reeve, on why the transportation segment was not why your committee decided not to do that. In fact, what really kind of puzzles me here is we're all ready to launch off on vehicle emission standards vis-a-vis California, and yet now we're saying that we don't want to track it or measure it. I'm trying to reconcile that.
Representative Burley, Madam Chair, the discussion concerning mobile sources did recognize that transportation is a key and very important player in terms of tracking, understanding greenhouse gas emissions for the state, developing that inventory. And there are a whole number of issues about, well, you know, how do you get there? Obviously, cars and trucks are very diverse and diffuse, and there are a number of different ways you can try to go about it. I mean, a lot of what we talked about was, is there anything available that's bottom up versus top down? And bottom up meaning coming from the user of the end user of the fuel or the vehicle, and top down coming more from the overall inventory. And are there places in between, such as fuel distribution and sales, where better information, better reporting would sort of be a place to eventually move to, you know, areas of either incentives or regulation, that which is far beyond the scope of our committee. Our committee was really just looking at, was there a way to easily achieve reporting that would be useful and it would gain us information that could be used for policymakers making policy choices about what to do next. And we didn't find a mandatory reporting sort of place that we could recommend to EQC to do at this time. We did say we'd like to look at it again, as I mentioned, but we, at this point, no. And we also looked at what the other states are doing. California, New Mexico, who already adopted rules, they have not gone there yet either.
So just to follow up, just to clarify, I should say what I'm hearing is that it's not that you're saying that the mobile sources aren't important. It's just that nobody's really figured out a good way to really measure or capture those emissions at this point.
Correct, Madam Chair. And on the flip side, there's a pretty good understanding of what those emissions are, because with greenhouse gases and vehicle use, for example, there's a mathematical relationship between fuel use and carbon emission. So when you know fuel sales, you get a very good idea of what emissions are.
So, Madam Chair, if I could just add to that, the committee did recommend that DEQ work with ODOT and other agencies to improve our inventory. As Mark said, if we can calculate pretty well what the overall emissions from transportation are, so we're not missing that sector. What we don't have, by not having reporting, is we won't know how much of it comes from this fleet or that fleet. And that will be useful information to have at some point, because when you have the fleet level information, that enables the fleet operators to see what they can do about reducing their own footprint. And so it may be useful at some point to get there, but we can implement, for example, the low emission vehicle program without having any reporting of that level. What we need to know to implement that program is the model years of vehicles that are sold, that they're complying with the standards, and we work with the auto manufacturers on that level.
So you can do a certain amount of modeling based on the sales, I mean, to some extent. I mean,
question.
Yeah, another question, then I'll bring David Vantoff up, because I think this will be an important part of the discussion with the WCI.
Specifically regarding Section 4, I think for you to say that this language would expand the EQC's authority is perhaps an understatement, because the way I read this thing, especially 4.1b, any person who imports, sells, or distributes for use in Oregon any product that generates greenhouse gases when the product is manufactured or used. So this pen that's manufactured in the state of New York, perhaps, I'm sure there's energy consumed in the production of this pen. So when these things are imported to the state of Oregon, we have to report on that? Is that what this is telling us?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the reason that we suggested writing this section broadly is that greenhouse gas emissions are a new area for us. Right now we know that electricity and fuel imports are key. It's possible that in the future there will be additional products that will be significant where it's worthwhile to collect reporting on that basis. There's no intent or plan to include that in an initial report. We're really focused on the imported electricity and fuels. But it's possible that it will be important for other products as well. And so the Environmental Quality Commission, when presented with information that there's a gap in our knowledge and our information, would have the authority to utilize that. But this section doesn't mandate any type of reporting. It just authorizes the commission to, if it's necessary for our inventory, to require the reporting.
Thank you. Comment, and then one last question, just so I don't monopolize the time here. If the intent is to deal with electricity or fuel, then I would suggest that that's what the language say. But when it says including but not limited to, it's anything. And I'd have a very hard time supporting that myself. I'm really curious about the ag and forestry. And, Mr. Reed, before you answer, I'm a forester, so I have some idea what goes on out in the woods. Help me understand, what's the issue with that as far as emissions? And, I mean, I look at forestry as sequestering, not emitting. So help me understand what the problems are and where the lack of authority is and what we need to do about that.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, again, we were looking at it only from the standpoint of the emissions inventory. We were not looking at any of these sectors as problems in themselves or even collectively. The inventory recognizes that forestry operations have a footprint, and certainly there's sequestration. There was some information presented about, to the extent forests are removed, deforestation has a footprint as well, and certainly there's use of fuel in industrial forestry operations and those sorts of things. So it really wasn't any more targeted than that. And so within the context of the inventory, we recognize that the overall statewide inventory that the Department of Energy has produced lists a certain segment as coming from forestry. It also lists a segment of greenhouse gases coming from ag, which is both fuel use and methane generation and things like that. So they were listed as contributors to the overall inventory, and that's why we looked at them but recognized that at this point reporting was not really something we could recommend at this point in terms of any kind of mandatory reporting system.
Okay, just to follow up to that, I guess my question when I read that is whether the mobile sources, for these sectors, obviously agriculture and forestry uses a lot of transportation for taking crops to market and obviously transporting forest products. So whether that would fall under the mobile sources or under these, sectors, however you decide, I guess it has to be captured somewhere.
Right. Madam Chair, that's correct, and those are some of the definitional issues that we're grappling with in the Western Climate Initiative. Is where does one source end and another begin? With climate change, it's particularly complicated, just as you pointed out.
Okay. Other questions from any other members? Yes. Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, and really appreciate you coming here today and discussing proposal. And we're going to have finally David Bantoff, who's going to talk about the Western Climate Initiative, and then we'll have some more input on LC70. Thank you, David. I think you're just going to Welcome. Happy New Year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Happy New Year to you. For the record, Dave Bantoff from the Governor's Office. And some materials are being distributed to the committee members, and these were these come off of the Western Climate Initiative website, and I wanted to just give folks who haven't had a chance to look through the website a flavor of kind of what's on the website. And so the first packet that you have is a press release announcing kind of the initiative, and some follow-up pages that talk about meetings and details. So I'm not going to walk through that, but they'll give you a sense of kind of some of the information that's available on the website. And then the other two packets that I'll get into touch on are focused on the electricity committee of the Western Climate Initiative, and I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. I'm the chair for that committee. And so on the website, there's the documentation for what each of the committees are doing. And as we're receiving comments, those are posted on the website as well. So those are the materials I'll talk about in a bit as I get into the presentation. But the thanks for the opportunity to talk to you all about the Western Climate Initiative. I look forward to hopefully being able to have an ongoing dialogue with the committee about kind of what's happening, progress that's occurring in the Western Climate Initiative. I think, as all of you know, the Western Climate Initiative is a regional approach to developing a cap-and-trade program for the Western United States and Canada. We've got right now seven members, states, and then two Canadian provinces. So nine jurisdictions altogether that have already joined the initiative, and we're hopeful to have several more join between now and August of 2008. The release of the launch of the initiative was focused on developing a regional greenhouse gas reduction goal for all member jurisdictions, an aggregate goal, and then also to develop a market-based program to achieve those reductions, or at least a portion of those reductions, in that the focus of the initiative is economy-wide. So we're not looking at just any one sector. We're not looking at just electricity or stationary sources or mobile sources. We're trying to look at it from a comprehensive economy-wide approach. The group developed the initial regional reduction goals as was required under the memorandum of understanding that was set out by the governors and the premiers. That was released in the beginning of this year, and now we're in the heart. It was released in August of 2007, and now we're in the heart of trying to develop the market-based program that's going to achieve the reductions that are set out, and the reduction goal. Just touching on that briefly, is formed around a 2005 baseline. As you all know, you passed legislation last session that for Oregon establishes reduction goals for the state that are tiered to 1990. And so for Oregon, our reduction goals are to at least or the 2020 reduction goals is to get 10% below 1990 levels by 2020. But the intent of the regional goal was to essentially take the aggregation of all the you could have expressed in terms of tons that were would have been achieved through each of the jurisdictions who have every one of the member jurisdictions have announced reduction goals either for the states or provinces, and it was essentially taking each of those individually, putting them into an aggregate, and expressing them in terms of the 2005 baseline. So we've been working on putting together the process and structure for getting the market-based mechanism in place by August of 2008, which is what the memorandum of understanding calls for. The intent is that if we can come up with a regional consensus and agreement as to a proposed program, that each of the jurisdictions would then bring it back to their respective jurisdictions and attempt to implement them. In most cases, that would be through legislative action. That's what we're intending to do. We're intending to come back for the 2009 session with the proposal, working with this committee, working with stakeholder groups to find what will work for Oregon and yet be consistent with the design that's agreed upon through the initiative. In terms of process now, in terms of developing that market-based approach, the initiative put together five committees, and they're focusing on different design elements of a market-based cap-and-trade program. There's, as I mentioned, the electricity committee. There's a scope committee. There's an allocations committee. There's an offsets committee, and there's a reporting committee. Each of those have a chair from one of the member jurisdictions and membership from all the participating jurisdictions that are working on those committees. The timing in terms of developing an approach that we're looking at is we kind of have to start with the scope and electricity
pieces to figure out, you know, we know that electricity will be part of the program, and really the question is how many other sectors or other things will be part of a cap and trade program. So the scope committee is really the initial step in figuring out what is the contours of who's going to be part of the program. And then once that's determined, and what the electricity committee is focused primarily on is what is the basis for including electricity. There's different design concepts that have been attempted by other attempts to develop cap and trade programs. You may have heard of some of these: a load-based approach, a generation-based approach, a first-seller approach. These are all set out in just very briefly in the one of the documents that I gave you, the approaches to covering electricity emissions. So for the electricity committee, one of the key things is what is the basis for the program design. Once those two committees have kind of developed those recommendations, that'll be integrated into the deliberations of the allocations and the offsets committees, because those are the key design elements. How are you allocating the emissions, and are there offsets included in the program, and if so, how are they included in the program? We're just getting into the details of the five committees. We have put out kind of issues papers asking for stakeholder responses as to, you know, this is what the committees think they're going to try and wrestle with over the next 6 months, and to get stakeholder input as to, are they the right issues? Are we kind of presenting them the right way? What are the initial feedback from stakeholders? Either they can get the initial feedback meaning from here's what you should do, to whether the design approaches and issue papers are covering the right things. One of the documents that I handed to you is the summary of stakeholder comments on the electricity subcommittee portion of the work plan. That just gives you a flavor of some of the comments that have come in. That's a collated attempt to summarize stakeholder comments. There's a much more lengthy document that's going to be posted. I think it's already on the website, but if not, it will be shortly, of all the comments that came in, so folks can see both, you know, every last page of comments, and then this is an attempt to kind of summarize kind of some of the key issues and comments that came out. And for each of the committees, there's similar documents. So there's comments on each of the committee work plans, and there's the specific issue papers for the committees. We're right now having our first regional stakeholder meeting for the initiative, and it's occurring in Portland, as some of you know, and are planning to attend, I hope. That's gonna be on the 10th, this Thursday. It's an all-day stakeholder meeting, and the five committees are going to kind of report in detail to the stakeholders that attend on what they've been looking at, talk a bit about stakeholder comments that have come in to date, and then get more oral and dialogue with stakeholders at that meeting on the 10th. It's the first of several regional stakeholder meetings we're planning to have between now and August of 08. We're having at least three of these, probably more. They'll be occurring throughout the WCI jurisdictions, so we'll be moving around the regional stakeholder meetings. This is a great opportunity for Oregon stakeholders to participate, to come, because it's easy to get to. In addition to the regional stakeholder meetings, I am developing, well, we have been having Oregon-specific stakeholder meetings on a monthly basis. We'll continue to do that between now and at least through the end of August, and then see if warrants continuing beyond the August time period. Or we have a listserv for stakeholders in Oregon that have an interest in the process, that they know about what's happening, when things are happening, and next steps. For the process, as I mentioned, we've got between now and August to develop final recommendations. There'll be a couple more iterations. So this is the first step is kind of presenting here are issues that the committees are looking at. The next step will be developing initial recommendations for the full member group, and when those initial draft recommendations come out, they will go out for public review and comment. We'll have another regional meeting to discuss those draft recommendations, and then the next iteration will be proposed final design recommendations from the full working group. in the full initiative. And again, we'll have regional, that'll go out for public comment. There'll be a regional stakeholder meeting to have input on those final recommendations, all prior to the final recommended design coming out in August. So we're hoping that we've built in a lot of opportunity for stakeholders to get all their issues fully heard, addressed, responded to, and integrated into the design elements for the program. And we're hopeful that we will have a really strong stakeholder supported design come out of the initiative in August.
Okay. Thank you. David, since given the limited time that we have left, I'd like to take a couple of questions, and then I'm going to have you stay up here because we're going to have a discussion of LC70, and I think there's a couple of things in there we want to make sure that you can address if there's any questions. So are there a couple of questions on the Western Climate Initiative? Just want to remind folks that we're going to have regular updates from Mr. Vantoff on this because, as you know, time is sort of, I guess, getting near where we're going to start hearing the recommendations. There is a meeting on Thursday. Representative Burley and I will be there, maybe some other members as well. And there's lots of information if you haven't looked already on the website, on the WCI website. It's a lot of information to review. But if there's some sort of basic questions here, we'll take a couple.
Thank you. Representative Burley. Dave, thanks for coming today. You know, one of the concerns that I have with this Western Climate Initiative process is that it's not really as public a process as I'd like to see it, especially when my feeling is that whatever comes of this thing next August is going to be in this building in January 2009, and the whole process of the legislature having the opportunity for public hearings and comment and talking about load-based versus, you know, generating-based and all these different alternatives out there, we're not going to have that opportunity, and that causes me a lot of concern. One of the things, for example, I've tried to find out is who are the members on these five subcommittees, and that information is not available on the web, at least it wasn't yesterday, the last time I checked. And I think it'd be helpful to know who's on there. I'm particularly interested to make sure that we've got folks in the private sector from the affected industries that are participating in this thing and not, you know, federal and state agency folks. I'm also a little bit concerned. I did pull off the subcommittee things in preparation for Thursday's workshop, which I'm actually looking forward to. But one of the things I was curious about, you know, a lot of decisions are being made. For example, it appears that based on this, it's unanimous amongst the WCI partners that we're going to go with the climate registry. And yet there's other registries out there. There's other protocols out there. You've got Newark Exchange, Chicago Exchange, and all these other things. And, you know, I don't see any of the pros and cons discussion about using those other things. The climate registry is a 501c3 corporation. The question is, how is that going to be funded long term, and should we make such a commitment to go with that versus something else? So, you know, I could go on forever. I've got all sorts of questions, and probably we'll have to sit down and spend some time together and go through this stuff. But these are the things that really caused me some concern about this process. I know that the federal government's looking at some legislation. This report does point out the Omnibus Appropriations Bill and some of these other things. So, you know, are we getting the cart before the horse? Are we making decisions too soon? Should we be looking at what the feds are trying to do? I mean, these are just all questions I've got, and I'm not sure if time permits to answer them all right now.
You've got about a minute to answer that.
Well, the short answer, Madam Chair, Representative Burley, is it would be great to sit down and kind of walk through these in a lot more detail. And anytime you've got time to do that, it would be a good start. A couple quick responses on the committee membership. As a response to your request as to who our committee members were, the initiative agreed that we're going to get that all posted on the website. I looked as well before coming over, and I didn't see it either. It's supposed to be on there, so the committee membership will be posted shortly. It should have already been on there. In terms of what the membership is, it is state staff. It's either governor's office or agency staff. The committees themselves are not staffed by private sector or NGO participants, and the way way that we've tried to develop a process here, is both in terms of the time frame and the complexity of kind of having negotiations with seven different jurisdictions, nine different jurisdictions, was to make sure that we had a very transparent process in the context of making sure that all considerations were fully aired prior to decisions being made, that there'd be numerous opportunities for comment, stakeholder comment, and for modifications based on stakeholder comment and responses to stakeholder comments. So we definitely have heard concerns about it's not a transparent process. Why can't the public be sitting on the committee meetings or the full plenary meetings? And we're trying to find that balance where there's every opportunity for input into the meaningful input into the process and for deliberation of that input. And then in addition, really the full public process that's going to occur under this is going to be when it comes back for implementation in the respective jurisdictions. And those are presumably going to go through committee hearings and full public process. So there's really kind of numerous chunks of opportunity for public input into the process. And then finally, on the climate registry, that was one of the preconditions that the governors just set out as and the premiers that initially formed the Western Climate Initiative, that was one of the conditions of joining. It was that the climate registry was being created. It's already got over, I think it's now, I don't know if Andy knows, is it 40? Is it 40? 40?
Yes.
Over 40 states and the Canadian provinces all are becoming part of that climate registry. So it's a strong likelihood that will be the basis for any mandatory reporting in North America going forward. It's not positive. It's possible that the EPA could say we're going to develop our own program that's going to be independent and different than that. But we're hopeful that this will become the basis for any mandatory program. And in fact, one of the goals of doing this, and why now? Why, you know, should we wait until kind of the feds take action on any of this stuff? One of the things that spurred my governor and the jurisdiction partners to move in advance of federal action was to try and make sure that we had our best opportunity to leverage the national discussion. And we're seeing that is playing out in terms of the climate registry, in terms of the proposed legislation that is being considered in Congress. We wanted to make sure that it wasn't just an East Coast-centric controlled process and looking at issues that were relevant to the East Coast. We wanted to make sure that West Coast issues are fully considered, and that one of the best ways to do that was to go through, just as the East Coast states went through a REGI process to develop a cap-and-trade program around generation-based, that by doing a Western-wide initiative would give us the most leverage in terms of that dialogue. So we think it's going to be very beneficial to our interests in the West.
Thank you, David. And given the interest of time, I'm going to encourage you two to go out for a very lengthy your session and talk about this. I know there's going to be a lot more discussion in the future. I just want to emphasize, though, that obviously all of any recommendations that come out of the WCI are, as you've mentioned, will probably be before this legislative body in 2009. So there will be ample opportunity for input and hearings and discussion. I'm assuming that many of the people who are in this room will be in this room again when we're discussing it in 2009. So appreciate that you're going to be keeping us well informed over the next few months on how that process moves forward. With that, I'm going to ask Beth to do a brief. We've already heard parts of LC70. Beth is going to do an overview. And then this is not an official work session. I'd like to ask members of the committee if they have any initial comments, and we'll ask members of the audience if they have initial comments. And then I'm going to ask people to email or call or write to Beth because we will be taking comments and then have another draft. I'm assuming that will be on the 25th before we're going to ask for any action. So, Beth, if you can provide an overview on LC70, appreciate it.
All the members have a copy of the LC draft. I'll just run through it quickly and skip over the parts that Andy has already described. Section 1 of the bill is a provision to bring in sections from House Bill 3543 from last session into this part of the statutes. That's pretty much all it does. Section 2 requires or directs state agencies to prepare plans to enable the state to meet the greenhouse gas emission reduction goals that were adopted in 3543, and it directs agencies to report on these plans to the Global Warming Commission.
Section 3 of the LC draft just puts the definitions from 3543 into the air quality statutes, moves them over. Section 4, Andy has already described, those are the authorities for EQC to adopt rules on greenhouse gas reporting. Section 5 and Section 6 are provisions that, as I understand it, are just clarifications to the statutes that were adopted establishing the Global Warming Commission related to non-voting and voting members of the commission. It's a cleanup provision. And then Section 7 of the LC draft directs the Office of the Governor and state agencies who are working on multi-state and regional efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to report to the Legislative Assembly as well as to the Commission, which was required by 3543. Section 8 of the bill is a repeal, and again, that's basically a cleanup from 3543 because we've brought the definitions over here. Section 9 is an emergency clause.
Thank you, Beth. Unfortunately, all of the committee members received this late yesterday afternoon because that's the first time that we had it, so I apologize for the fact that this went out so late. So I just saw it for the first time last night. Would like to get any comments from the committee members, and then we'll have about time for about 2 minutes each for people to come up. And then, as I mentioned, we're going to encourage folks if they'd like to email or call us as well. And so, David, I don't know if you want to be here to answer any questions in case there are. Want some too. All right. So any comments from the committee members? I know we've heard already on Section 4 a concern from Representative Burley about subsection, I think, B being overly broad. I think we'll certainly take that into consideration and look at narrowing the scope of that, have discussions with LC about that. I had some questions about Section 2, Subsection 1, whether we want to require all agencies to report or look at either a phased approach or limiting it initially, at least to agencies that possibly have the biggest impact, concerned about, do we need to have Foley, for instance, reporting to us? That was a question I had. I think, though, the other issues that we had discussed here at the last committee meeting about making sure that there's coordination with the governor's office and the WCI process and just making sure that we're moving forward towards meeting our goals and having good information on that. So any comments? Yes. Representative Garrard. Representative Burley.
Madam Chair, I don't really know whether Davis want to answer this or you or Chuck, but I'm a little confused in Section 3 on number C7. Talking about wood stoves.
Maybe Andy, who's going to answer that for us. I'm sorry, what's the line number? Section 3?
Yeah, line 11 and 11 through 17 on page 3.
Andy, do you want to come up and answer that?
I mean, I really love this. I can see the people in Klamath and Oak Ridge, in particular, out there looking at their wood stove saying, wow, a low firing cycle means less than or equal to 25% of the maximum burn rate achieved with doors closed. Is this talking about the doors to the wood stove closed? Or
and Representative,
open?
I believe this is an existing definition, but Andy, if you'd like to give us the sort of layperson description of...
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Greg. This is an existing definition, and it lines up with the federal definition for a wood stove. They have a wood stove certification program, as you well know, anything that meets this definition is subject to it, and anything that doesn't isn't.
Andy, I'm more interested in how its application is being used as part of this bill.
It's not related to this bill at all, Representative Greer, Madam Chair. It's just
there for
one of the existing definitions. These new definitions are inserted in with them.
And it's not a new definition.
It's not a new definition, and it's not referred to in the bill at all.
Is it because of a renumbering with
it's a renumbering of an existing definition.
And that's the only reason it's in here?
Yes.
Okay, I'm done.
You're easy.
Yeah.
All right, Representative Hurley.
Thank you. I think this will probably be just about as easy. Section 2, are we going to get any physical impact statement of this requirement?
Yes.
Okay. And then for Mr. Vantoff, why haven't we got this Global Warming Commission appointed yet?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, we are, I believe, going to be announcing that any day. It's the holidays and a few things slowed us down, but it will be very, very shortly announced.
Okay. Thank you.
Before the February session, you think?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
There you go.
Great.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Representative Cannon.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Well, I look forward to, having just received this, to hearing from others about it. But I would point out that there are certain respects in which I think it's more a more modest proposal than some, at least, of what we talked about at our last meeting. I'm somewhat disappointed, I suppose, that it doesn't say more or go to greater lengths to reinforce the requirements or the proposal that we passed, 3543, with respect to state greenhouse gas reductions. We did talk about the possibility of making those mandatory. This draft does not include language to that effect. I think it's certainly worthy of debate whether or not we ought to do that or not, but I thought it could have and should have been on the table. So I think in that respect and others, it's somewhat a more modest step than we had considered at the last meeting, but I certainly look forward to hearing folks' thoughts.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I tend to agree with part of the statement there, and in that the timeline of having this now and not having really had a chance to really look at it and get input from other people. I've gotten some input with concerns, and so I am looking forward to hearing more from interested parties out there on where they stand on this particular piece of legislation. I have concerns that we could find ourselves in not a very nonpartisan bill and a very short period of time to be looking at it in February. So that's why I'm hoping to hear more.
Thank you. Hey, David, have any comments? Or?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is, I also received this yesterday afternoon, evening, and we're working our way through it. Internally, we're trying to get a sense of what we think the bill does as well. So look forward to weighing in as we go forward.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you, David. And what I'm going to do is ask people if they would like to come up. I know many people have just received the bill as well. If you want to share any initial thoughts, I'd also like to ask folks that you're welcome to email or send us in comments, and Beth will be summarizing those and getting those out to the committee. And what I'll probably do is I may have the subcommittee of the vice chairs, again, we get together and look at the comments. I would like to have a draft back, obviously, out before our final pre-session hearing on January 25th, is that correct?
Right.
So hopefully we can turn that around rather quickly. Unfortunately, our Ledge Council drafter is going off to Kazakhstan on a voluntary basis. We're not banishing him there. Although I think he's doing it just to avoid the February session. But hopefully he'll be able to provide any changes in a timely manner so we can get a draft out before the 25th. So what I'm going to do is just have people come up three at a time. I'm going to give you about a minute. Just cut it down from 2 minutes. Just please make sure and state your name for the record. So appreciate it. And don't be shy. And if you'd rather do it in writing, that's fine as well.
We're getting
okay. Well, you're alone there.
John Ledger, Vice President, Associated Oregon Industries. We're the largest comprehensive business association. We represent about 300 manufacturers and who will be affected. And we supported the goals bill that came out to pass limiting CO2 reductions. I just had some quick comments on these. And emission inventories are the first thing you always do whenever you're going to have any program that deals with lowering of any kind of contaminant. So this is the logical first step to do. The key is how do you do it. And our basic point is we like it to be fair, and we like it to be done in the most efficient, cost-effective manner possible. One question I had, maybe Andy can answer this, on Section 2, where it talks about each agency to evaluate the economic costs and benefits of implementing the recommendations, we don't know if that means to the agency or to the state as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
And we would certainly hope that the agencies in developing the recommendations would look at a cost analysis on what it's going to cost the state as a whole, the business economy. It's going to cost something, but the cost of doing nothing may well be higher. But we need to go in with our eyes wide open, and I think it's a reasonable thing on something of this scope to say what are the economic costs going to be as far as employment goes or dislocation, things like that. That's important for people to know. And it may have to happen anyway, but it's something we need to know. I think that everyone has concern about the Oregon, about the products being constructed out of state and having to having to deal with those emissions. I think that's an issue. We would probably come in with some proposed language on guidance. I think it's a good idea to get guidance to the EQC on how they do this. I think on dealing with any enforcement agency, which the DEQ is, it's wise policy to give them the authority you want them to have and not more. And so I think this is an example of where the legislature could give them very specific directions that I think everybody would agree on this is how you want to implement it. There are different ways of doing emission inventories. You can do them by engineering calculations, which can be very good because you know how many atoms of carbon are going in, or you can do them by constant ambient, you can do it by constant, for instance, stack monitoring, which doesn't get you that much more but is wildly expensive. And so I think building some direction in to telling the EQC that these are the things you're going to take into consideration. There's no point in getting extremely precise when you're looking at millions of tons. And I think that kind of guidance, we'd be happy to bring you some language that I think would help and make this a better bill.
Great. Thank you, John. And if you could get that to Beth in a timely manner, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I represent the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association, which are 18 small distribution utilities that serve about 10% of Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to make some comments, and I will follow up with some written comments since we just received this yesterday. But I did need to come forward and share a concern that we have with the bill. I have to say I also agree with what Mr. Ledger just said, and there is going to be cost involved in this. And the issue in the bill that causes us some concern on looking at it just with a first blush is that this obviously is intended to capture consumer-owned utilities in a mandatory reporting process with the Department of Environmental Quality, something that we are not subject to at this current moment. And I find it a little hard to believe, based on the comments that I've heard before about not including transportation, that they are key and important players, and we probably do need to look to that. I don't believe that rural electric cooperatives are key and important players in this. They're small distribution utilities that use 100% Bonneville power, that is 70 to 90% hydropower or wind power that has no emissions whatsoever. And I know many of you might say, what's the problem with a report? Well, if you're West Oregon Electric Co-op, who has the highest rates in the state of Oregon, and who just lost their administrative offices to a flood, they now have to move them to a different location. They just lost their whole substation to the flood. They were hit severely by the storm, worse than any utility in the whole state. They're looking at having to build a new facility, build a new substation, build a whole new transmission line, and underground it because it keeps going down. And they already have the highest cost in the state. These mandates do cost money, and for a very, very small utility that has five or six people in the office, you know, it is important. And I just want to remind you how important it is. They have 45 mandatory reports today, state government, federal government reports that they have to do. And it's my job to come up here and remind you that that does cost money. And when you have the challenges that we have in distributing electricity in this state, you have to be concerned about any new cost. And we like to look at cost associated with benefit. And for the kind of power that we use, there's no reason for us to report. We would prefer, and what we have said all along, is the generation source needs to be the reporting entity, and that's Bonneville Power. We would have to go to them to get all the information anyway. And so if you're going to look at who you're going to extend this reporting requirement to, I hope that you think about who the key and important players are. And I would like you to understand that we don't believe that rural electric cooperatives are key and important players with the power source that we have.
Thank you for your comments, Sandy. And if you could provide that, and if you prefer, in writing, email, letter to Beth, that would be really helpful.
Thank you.
Anybody else like to come up, share some thoughts, or on the record? Yes, come on up. Don't be shy. I know you're not shy. And please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lana Butterfield. I'm with the Northwest Propane Gas Association. We will be also submitting some written comments. I guess what I'd like to say to you is that our members, that we have about 100 dealers, and they're small businesses, and they don't generate the fuel, they simply sell it. And they have a lot of concerns about all of this, some of which have to do with trade secrets and that kind of thing. And so we will be submitting some written comments to you with our concerns.
Great. Thank you. Okay, anybody else? Come on up.
Hi, thank you. My name is Kay Moxness, and I'm with Central Lincoln People's Utility District based at Newport. What I wish to ask you is if you have considered a carbon use tax. You have the, everything I've seen during last session and during the interim now relates to a cap and trade system. And a cap and trade system can be extremely complex, easily gamed, and I'm hoping that you would still consider a carbon use tax, a transparent tax at the end of the sale. And I think it's something that has been inadequately considered here and elsewhere, but it's still being considered at the national level.
Thank you, Kay, for coming forward with that. Just to answer you, the scope of this bill is only really focused on reporting on how to meet the goals that was set in the climate change bill that was passed last session and also the reporting requirements under DEQ. I guarantee you that in 2009 there will be a lot of discussion about how those goals should be met, whether it should be through a cap-and-trade system or through carbon tax or some other mechanism. I think the discussion that you've heard about the cap and trade has been through the Western Climate Initiative, isn't it?
Yes, it's in your section 3.8, 3.9. Excuse me.
Okay, yeah, so that has not been set yet. It's been discussed in the climate change.
So would you have also, perhaps you could add a definition for a carbon use tax and perhaps put a little work into that, you know, at this time, alongside the greenhouse gas cap and trade system.
Thank you for that suggestion.
Okay.
You can look at broadening that language.
Okay.
Thank you. Anybody else? All right. And just a reminder, Beth will be working on this the next week or so, so please send in any additional comments. Before I adjourn, what I would like to do is Beth's going to give a brief update on LC 90, because we're not going to hear that today, and you're going to hear why.
LC 90 is the bill that addresses a fix to the dental waste bill from last session. And what the LC does is basically amends the exemption language that was in Senate Bill 704 to include dentists who are certified by an association that manages wastewater. And there are still some concerns that we have not captured all of the different types of wastewater treatment entities that are out there that dentists work with. So we're going to work further on that language and make sure that we've got everybody covered.
Okay. So stay tuned. This bill will be back.
It will.
Our next meeting is on the 25th. I hope to see everybody here. I'm sure we'll see a lot of familiar faces in the audience. And with that, just would like to thank staff for their excellent job and appreciate the attention of the committee. And we'll see you on the 25th. With that, I will adjourn the House Energy and Environment Committee.